everyone. Thank you very much for joining me today for a very special event with Professor Brenda Schaefer. Today we're discussing international energy policy, very hot topic given the current trends and what is really happening geopolitically speaking. And to introduce myself, I'm Zuna Bribua, research fellow at the Center for Peace and Security in the Middle East. I mainly work on Russia and China in the Middle East and in North Africa. So very honored to have you with us, Brenda. So Professor Brenda Schaefer is an international energy and foreign policy specialist focusing on the interplay between natural gas trade and foreign policy, politics and energy in the South Caucasus, Iranian natural gas exports and ethnic politics in Iran, and Eastern Mediterranean energy. Professor Schaefer is a research faculty member of the Energy Academic Group at the US Naval Postgraduate School. She is also a senior advisor for energy at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, FDD, and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center in Washington, DC. Brenda, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
So we're here to discuss, of course, international energy policies and so on, but also to discuss a very provoking report on disempowering Africa and really the impact international energy policies had on developing countries, especially the African one. But you know, before we go to questions, I was wondering what inspired you to write this report?
You know, I think if we were to build a case study over the last 10 years, how to raise energy prices, weaken the West geopolitically, hurt energy security, and especially among the world's poorest and most vulnerable, raise emissions, raise pollution, that would be what we did over the last 10 years. So it's quite, you know, sometimes when you look back in history and you see, you know, something like, you know, I don't know, people would do human sacrifices and remove a heart and thinking this would affect the weather. And we think, oh, how could people have been so, you know, why do they think that human sacrifice would change the weather for them, right? But what we've done in the most, like, from the Paris Agreement in the past 10 years, but specifically, but most intensely in the past 5 years, has brought such tremendously negative results that it almost feels like something like that. I'm just seeing in the last couple of days, so suddenly people are starting to unravel. So let's say if the International Energy Agency 5 years ago published net zero, we don't need any more oil and gas, no more new investments. And this was used, you know, as a roadmap for Wall Street to dry up investments for fossil fuels. It was used for lawfare cases against energy, you know, fossil fuel companies that are operating legally, you know, the backbone of American energy, you know, energy supplies and energy exports. These papers of the International Energy Agency were being used for this. World Bank deciding that 45% of their grants will go for climate finance versus eradicating poverty. And you're seeing now these some of these organizations unraveling. Like, let's say a lot of the insurance companies that wouldn't insurance fossil fuels, now they're saying, okay, they're going to go back to insure it. People that were members of the Glasgow Finance Alliance for Net Zero that Mark Carney and Michael Bloomberg founded, that basically signed up banks and other companies not to invest in fossil fuels, right? So you're seeing companies leave this. You're seeing the IEA suddenly saying we need to invest in fossil fuels, but where were we for the past 5 years? 5 years we've been hearing energy transition, just a matter of days. I mean, Biden even stopped U.S. export of LNG, liquefied natural gas, and that went past, you know, most of Americans, like, okay, I guess that's good. I guess that's fine. So I think just because our policies have been so destructive, but in the end of the day, they've been extremely regressive also, which is meaning that the people that paid, like, for when you have high energy prices in high and middle income countries, the people that pay for that are the poor. Because for most of you, If your electricity bill goes up $20 a month, $30 a month, you don't like it, but you can manage with it. But for a pensioner on a fixed income, this might mean, do I turn on the heating boiler this week? Do I not turn on the heating? And this affects health. And then the worst story is actually in sub-Saharan Africa, all of Africa, but most intensively in sub-Saharan Africa, where if people don't have access to energy, it's not like they're just going to sort of like the way the Green New Deal describes it, that they're just going to live in harmony with the animals and dance around and things like that. It means they're going to be condemned to burning smoke and living with indoor pollution and, having a very low, short life expectancy. A lot of children that die from respiratory diseases are afflicted with blindness, from growing up with this indoor pollution. It's almost this idea that people who walk around, who I'm against fossil fuels, they're sort of like the good guys, and the bad guys are the people that are, let's say, standing up for people in Africa to not have to be living with indoor pollution. It's also kind of a strange moral situation.
So what I found interesting, not just on your report, but also on your other writings and your analysis, is that you're not just debunking the policy of how it's not working, but you're debunking really the assumption behind the policy. For example, here you said that many in the development industry, as well as some Western politicians, claim that Africa can leapfrog over the fossil fuel stage directly to modern renewables. I would like for you to expand on that and why, as you wrote, this claim is not tenable.
Right. So, if you talk to a lot of activists and, members of Congress, members of parliaments, the leapfrogging idea sounds very attractive. I like the frogs, that you can use the physical example too, but it just sounds really good. Why should you go through the fossil fuel era? But someone can say that, only someone who doesn't understand how electricity works. So today's renewables cannot deliver stable electricity that can provide power for modern economies. And not only is it unstable, but we don't have the capacity for the type of energy that you need in modern cities. That we can't produce enough wind towers, solar panels, even if you were going to say it's okay to have unreliable energy. But what does unreliable energy mean? If you have frequent disruptions because of the volatility of renewables, that means, for instance, you can't have modern medicine. You need refrigeration for vaccines, for medicines. So if that's disrupted all the time and then everything goes bad in those refrigerators, you're not going to use these vaccines. You're not responsibly going to use these vaccines. Or if you're an investor and you're thinking, should I go into Tanzania or should I go to Greece? Well, Greece is going to give me more or less reliable electricity. In Tanzania, I'm going to have to build generators. So I think I'll go to Greece. It's such a pull, a place that has reliable electricity. And then if you take the risk of going to a place with unreliable electricity, it means you're going to have a cost that your machines are constantly being destroyed. So for instance, if you have a hairdryer and it's using it on the wrong frequency in your home, and then you destroy the machine, right? Well, this is what happens from unreliable electricity. You actually destroy the machinery from the change in frequency. So that's a cost. But this idea, there's something I think it's even, definitely a modern form of discrimination by the West, World Bank, International Energy Agency, the G7. They're promoting only off-grid solar for Africa. About a fourth of the newer hookups of electricity in the last 10 years in Africa have been off-grid solar. And what does that mean? Again, it sounds cool, right? Like you have your little solar unit.
That's
out.
It sounds cool.
It sounds cool, right?
It's signaling.
You want one. I think you want, yeah? You want your little off-grid solar here?
But I was thinking that this is also something, is that it's really about the signaling, because the policy just does not make sense.
Right. So what does off-grid solar mean? It means you have enough electricity for a lantern at night. You could charge a cell phone. Okay, that's good for maybe if you're doing some business, but you can't use a power tool. You don't have water pump. Mm. You can't get clean water into your home. You can't really lift out of poverty. There are no energy poor countries that are wealthy, high income countries. It goes together. Energy is the precondition. reliable energy is a precondition for rising from poverty. You know, and by the way, what are we doing in the West through our policies of combining a lot of unreliable renewables with a base load, with constant power, is that we're basically creating two energy systems running at once, because it's not enough to have just the renewables, because it's unreliable and it's not doesn't deliver the goods. But we're also paying to keep the base load. So we are increasing our energy costs. And you're seeing this, I mean, probably the best example is it Germany, that really went full in as much as possible in an energy transition. And now they're completely deindustrializing. I mean, I every day when I read the reports of how many factories are closing in Germany and jobs lost, you really don't believe it. It's almost as if it's some kind of dystopia.
Yeah, and so what you basically explain is that because there is this adoption of renewables, there are less, these African countries cannot really get themselves out of poverty, and so they are in this perpetual cycle that they can't really escape. And can you explain how a lot of these international organizations, the World Bank, etc., who have as a mission to fight and end poverty, keep these African countries in this cycle?
It's quite unbelievable. Until I did the research on this paper, I couldn't imagine how extensive or maybe how cruel the World Bank is, because, okay, first thing, 45% of their funding dedicated to climate finance, you know, so not necessarily to eliminating poverty, but also in their things that are so-called eliminating poverty, like energy work, they completely, in defiance of their expertise, because I'm sure their energy people know what they're doing, they only offer renewable policies for Africa, right? So when they say, okay, we have a problem, a big problem in Africa, which I mentioned, is clean cooking. So people always need energy. If you don't have electricity, it's not like you don't use energy. You're going to burn wood, dung, biomass. And so one of the first things you want to do to help human health, human development, is to replace the clean cooking with replace dirty smoke with clean, you know, non-polluting alternatives. So when they discuss this problem in all their reports, they say, well, they can do, you know, solar, off-grid solar, this, but they know that that's not going to replace stoves, that you can't cook with solar, you know, I mean, maybe do a little camping, you can heat, you can't cook, you know. So you're not going to solve the main problems, but or even the last report of the International Energy Agency on clean cooking, you know, the Norwegian Development Agency sends them a few hundred thousand dollars to talk about Africa. Everyone feels they're like good people. They mention that burning of wood and biomass, right, what happens when you don't have energy, creates more pollution, more emissions, and more health dangers than fossil fuels. But still, they don't advocate for funding fossil fuels for Africa. So it's almost like fossil fuels are something, you know, like a religious thing. You can't touch it. It's out of reach. You know, you shouldn't touch it, even if it would be good for you. Well, that's not rational. And also, they don't mention IEA and World Bank. They never mention baseload in their reports, which, you know, like, again, any of those people in the energy world, you know that renewables need a stable baseload. So if you don't talk about baseload power, you really are not, when you say they can do this with solar, this with wind, this with geothermal, you're really not, you know you're not telling the whole story. And then I think also this issue of partial electricity supply, the idea that we all feel comfortable, you know, people come to the World Bank meetings here, and that they feel comfortable saying, okay, Africans should have unreliable energy, electricity, and I'm okay with that. I don't know how they do that.
If I had to play the devil's advocate, they would say it's about protecting the wildlife, it's about protecting the environment, but you also consider yourself an environmentalist.
Yeah, I have to
so
say.
So, what's the argument you make?
So, I have to say that I got to the position of, let's say, climate challenging, as a real, you know, diehard environmentalist. I have to say, someone mostly inspired by my son, who came to this idea as a young man, you know, even as an early teens, even before me. But the idea that, first thing, we have very few environmental organizations left. They're mostly climate organizations. And when climate and green clash, they go for climate. Like, for instance, all the reports on Africa mention mining. You know, Africans shouldn't produce oil and gas. There's just being stranded assets. There's going to be no demand for oil in the future. They should just give it up. They should start mining. You know, so mining suddenly is green. I mean, like, has anyone ever seen what a mine site, you know, looks like? And also that deepens African dependence, because if you develop your own oil and gas resources and you use some of them domestically, then you can have your own, you know, you can lower costs at home, you can have a manufacturing, you can, if you produce natural gas, you could produce fertilizer cheaper, and then you could have cheaper farming, cheaper food. But if you just mining, you know, for critical minerals for the renewable energy, you're going to export these. It's probably going to go to a handful of, you know, billionaires anyways in Africa, and then it's just going to bring, and I'm sure that money wasn't even coming to Africa. Probably most of it sits in banks and, you know, outside of Africa. So people won't benefit from mining. They will benefit from, you know, oil and gas development, especially natural gas, which they could use for electricity.
Yeah, so I think your point on the African dependency is very accurate, but also there's a great paradox, right? Because since the Russia's war on Ukraine, you see European countries, especially because they massively support renewables through grants and projects, etc., saying that these are the only projects they will support in Africa, while there are other projects developing in Africa that can actually help Europeans diversify from Russian oil and gas. How is it? Is this something accurate? Do you think that this is one of the biggest consequences, I mean, geopolitically speaking, of this?
Yes, I don't know. I think it's a huge consequence. You know, first thing, because Europe has legislation where it doesn't want to lock itself into so-called dependence or consumption of natural gas, it makes it very hard. Legislation makes it very hard for its companies to sign long-term gas import contracts. So there are a lot of places like Azerbaijan, Israel, Nigeria that would want to export gas into Europe. That would be very good for Europe. That would make them less dependent. That could lower their gas prices, because pipeline gas tends to be a lot cheaper than liquefied natural gas, LNG, which is what, you know, they have to use if they don't have the pipeline gas. So they could lower prices, they could increase their security of supply, but because of this ideology of not getting locked into fossil fuels, they really make it hard for a producer to bring gas into Europe. And second, you know, just in general, if you look at the electricity of Europe, UK, you know, most of the NATO allies of the United States, because they've followed this ideology, they have now some of the most expensive electricity in the world and the least reliable or less reliable than they had before. Well, this is a national security problem as well. Like, and this is another security burden for the United States that we have, you know, with all the cyber attacks and hybrid warfare and stuff, that basically, you know, our allies are not taking care of having reliable electricity. We just saw this, for instance, you know, in the name of climate policy, which is kind of funny because nuclear, you know, doesn't have any carbon emissions. But Taiwan just shut down its last nuclear power plant. So, like, if you're an island and it's easy to, it's pretty wild. If you're an island and it's easy to, you know, to blockade your energy supplies, so you need either a lot of storage of energy, which Taiwan doesn't have adequate storage, or you need something like nuclear, where, you know, you get one shipment in. And you can, you know, you can have enough electricity for a year, you know, from the fuel you have. And so the idea that they feel in this security environment with China that they should shut down their nuclear. I mean, Japan didn't even shut down their nuclear after Fukushima. Fukushima, the tsunami in Fukushima shut down nuclear in Germany, in Taiwan, but, you know, not in Japan. So it is a real national security issue.
Yeah, and building up on this, because so Europe and the West is basically losing on the energy security front, but there's also the fact that because they are not encouraging the global, because Sub-Saharan Africa is part of this global South, et cetera, they're not encouraging reliable sources of energy, China and Russia are filling the void. Especially China. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on this.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point that, you know, so when USAID was closed down, you heard a lot of people, including Republicans.
Yeah, the end of soft power.
Yeah, end of soft power. How is America going to compete with China? Now, I don't remember 3 years before that when the G7 said no funding for fossil fuels. I don't remember any of these people saying, wait, energy, like countries need energy. That's very basic. If the West isn't out there, if the G7 isn't out there, who's going to be there? Because people want power supplies. They want electricity supplies. So nobody was shouting that we're actually one of the most strategic sectors. We're handing on a silver plate to China and to Russia in Africa, which is, you know, as you're an expert on Africa and especially on China and Russia in Africa, that, you know, it's the fastest growing population in the world. You know, most likely in 2050, about a fourth of the world will be African. The West should take an interest for a variety of reasons, but including, you know, geopolitically. So, and I would say also it's pretty surprising that still with the Trump administration, first thing, the first, you know, the World Bank cut its funding of fossil fuels actually during the first Trump administration, and didn't hear, you know, guidance from the Secretary of Treasury then that, well, as the main funder of the World Bank, we don't want this, whatever. But it still hasn't happened. I'm thinking, well, maybe I know in October the administration is going to have its review of international organizations, but it really should be, you know, if the U.S. is a main funder to the World Bank, it should make it clear that it's not handing over the energy sectors to China, and that the U.S. will, it, some of that funding will be going for at least, you know, electricity produced from natural gas, which, you know, which isn't polluting and.
Yeah, it's a huge loophole because the World Bank, of course, is not just energy projects. It can give a lot of grants and so on, and a lot of countries, they take the grants. They say that they're going towards some sector or whatever, but it actually goes to Chinese companies.
Wow.
And I thought that there are so many loopholes that China has been exploding for a very long time. And so, like, part of your recommendations is also to take into consideration this geopolitical dimension of it. I was wondering if you can also say more about how you think a reshuffling of U.S. energy policy can help.
International energy policy. So first thing, I think we need to think that the energy sector, through the climate policy, has been really used to expand global governance in a way that, you know, almost, you know, unprecedented. Like, you know, your tax money goes up, you see the money going to these international organizations, and they get deeper and deeper into our lives. Now, what's really dangerous about this? Like, if Germany and the UK have their energy prices going up and stuff, that, well, they can, you know, they can have an election and they can toss the government out. But who tosses out the people that have been running these energy transition policies and drying up finance to Africa? Well, they finish their terms, they get their good pensions, you know, they get their next job in the UN, or, you know, so I there's like no accountability. And, you know, for instance, we've been hearing for about the past 5 years, the energy, what? The energy
transition,
right? Everywhere you go, the energy transition, the energy transition. It's not an energy transition, a potential energy transition. It's the energy transition. Presented everywhere that it's a train that left the station, just come on board. When are you getting on board? Your city, your country, right? Well, the last report of the Energy Institute, which is one of the most reliable sources of energy data, came out in June 2025. And they didn't put this information in their press release or in their executive summary. But it turns out that now in the world, their estimates, and this is probably the most professional body today on energy data, that fossil fuels provide 87% of global energy. So we've gone from assessments at last year of 81.6 to 87. So it is an energy transition. It's an energy transition to fossil fuels, to greater use. Maybe the energy transition of more natural gas, you know, relative to other fossil fuels. But the idea that, I mean, who thought of this idea? I mean, even she says, we're not going to replace our energy system until there's a new one in place. Who thought of the great genius idea? Let's get rid of fossil fuels, and then when people don't have energy, they'll have to build renewables. Or maybe they'll die, they'll shiver, their economies will collapse, they'll deindustrialize, they'll be taken over by foreign powers, you know. So one is that, yeah, and then we have to remember that while the West has been deindustrializing, creating unreliable and expensive electricity, if you look at like the electricity prices in China and its allies in the global South, they're much cheaper, you know, like a fifth cheaper than electricity in the UK or Germany. And coal is the main source of their electricity. So as we so-called decarbonize, I don't know, I'm afraid to decarbonize because we'd also disappear. But as we've been decarbonizing, making our electricity more expensive and less reliable, they've been making it cheaper, more reliable, and also more polluting and more emitting and wiping out anything the West has done in reduction of pollution and emissions.
You know, there's something I thought was super interesting that you wrote about, and it's the how, first of all, we actually don't know if there is full electricity access, because there is this maneuvers that of the categorizations that World Bank and UN the UN do, where they put like we don't know if a source is reliable or not, and they put it in one big category.
Right.
And so you look at it, you say, oh yeah, there's full electricity access, but there isn't. And you found a lot of these kind of maneuvers that they've been doing. Do you think it's a Chinese operation there, or do you think these are committed people to the climate change, energy transition ideology?
I think that's a good question. I think combination of both depends. I would say like on some of this like calculation of let's say the IEA had money for a gender program, which I don't really know why. I don't really care about women and hydrogen. I get invited sometimes to these panels, like women and green hydrogen. I'm trying to understand, I'm getting off the gender angle of green hydrogen, but whatever. But it's kind people invite, but sorry, I just don't understand the gender angle. But in order to raise the data on the number of women in energy, they'll count, you know, women that gather sticks and manure in Africa as energy workers.
That's interesting.
Or they'll count what's called traditional renewables. I mean, it is renewable because the goats continue to produce it, right? Like, but that they'll count that as renewable energy. So you're saying like, you know, 20% of Mali is renewable energy. Yeah, but this is biomass, which is not healthy for the people. It doesn't rise, you know, help them rise from poverty. China angle, where I think, and I'm coming out soon with a publication on this, that I think it really affected the war on natural gas. So up to about 2018, 2019, sort of the standard was you want to lower emissions, you want to lower pollution, you bring in natural gas, switching from coal to gas. That's the way to do it. Suddenly in 2018, 2019, you see the World Bank, International Energy Agency, European Union, suddenly against gas. Now we have to eliminate all fossil fuels, not just coal and oil. And this happened without any new research, new sort of thing about, and then suddenly maybe you guys start hearing methane is a more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. It's like, well, I don't know, where is this based? You know what I mean? It was like sort of someone wrote it, but like suddenly this became this widespread consensus. And of course, this idea that you get rid of all fossil fuels when in the reality, maybe they didn't even know, but you know, we're 87% fossil fuels, it's not a very practical policy. You probably should come up with something else to avert climate change than getting rid of your source of energy. But where I saw the Chinese connection, a couple of things. First thing, around the same period, 2017, 2018, 2019, you saw a lot of Chinese money going into global environmental organizations. I mean, even just the transparent stuff that we could see, like to Rocky Mountain Institute and the National Defense Council. I mean, you see it like in their the tax forms of some of these Chinese-sponsored NGOs in the United States that send the money to these organizations. So you see, like, for instance, Rocky Mountain Institute gets a $650,000 grant. For that organization, it's a small organization. That's a big part of their budget, to promote public health. And then suddenly they come out with a study on why gas stoves are bad for public health, you know. And then,
so it comes from this, the gas stoves propaganda.
I'm waiting for who's behind the shower heads, because I want the water pressure back, okay? This was at the same time. So what happened in parallel? Like, why is China suddenly giving all these money to environmental organizations to work against natural gas? Mm-hmm. Is they realized they couldn't frack, like that their geology is not, this isn't a bad word, like not frackable, right? And they have water shortages and there's a lot of reasons. And so what did that mean? That's recognizing that the U.S. is not, because of the shale revolution, the U.S. was not only the strongest military power in the world, and the strongest, you know, technology power in the world. But now it's going to become the manufacturing power of the world, because if you have cheap energy, I mean, energy is the biggest input into manufacturing. You know, more that we think it's like cheap labor, but it's actually cheap. You know, energy decides. And like if you saw after the shale revolution, all these companies that moved from Mexico into the United States to get cheaper energy. So China realizes, wow. If America becomes an energy power, it's really going to beat us. It's a big problem. So you see all these environmental organizations, they start getting money from China. They start praising China. China's a leader in green tech. China's the leader in the electro powerhouse. What's the new term they're using now? Electron power, the first electro state, and all this. And then at the same time, they attack natural gas. But what do they because of methane? But global emissions of methane from natural gas, 4%. When I found this data, I could not believe it. I really thought I'm missing a zero or at least a one or something. 4%. Global emissions from Chinese rice emissions from Chinese rice cultivation. Any guess? 10%. So if you were going to find a low-hanging fruit or a low-hanging rice. Wouldn't you go for the Chinese? Like, if you're really serious about methane is so dangerous, wouldn't you go for Chinese rice? I know a couple times I've presented about methane in Asia, and people there, rightfully so, you're saying, are you trying to tell us to give up the staple of our diet because of climate? Well, I'm saying, well, should the United States give up the staple of its electricity for climate? None of them they make sense. But the environmental organizations focus on natural gas, you know, deprive the West of its power, but they would never think about attacking the rice cultivation in China and in Asia.
Yeah, naturally. And so there's this great paradox. And I wanted to go back to your comments on Trump administration and also the Biden administration, because you wrote a whole section about it, about how they were actively also undermining domestic energy production and basically weakening America's industrial capacity and so on. But I don't think many people understand that. And I want you to elaborate a little bit about what they've actually been doing.
Right, so most of the Western countries, United States, Canada, European countries, over the last, certainly over the last 5 years, have been putting, you know, special regulations in place, legislation in place, taxes in place, to make it much more difficult and expensive to produce natural gas, which again, you know, let's say the Labour government came into the UK, they closed down the North Sea. So it's better for them to import gas from Qatar than to develop their own gas. The Biden administration before the election, and sort of a throw a bone to the young people that would, I don't know, young people like the dark, or I don't know what the story is, but you know, stop new permits for LNG export. So this means, you know, so it didn't immediately have an effect, but all over the world, people say, can't really trust the United States as a gas supplier. because who knows, a Democratic administration comes in or even Congress and they'll shut it down again. So I don't know, I'll better do some deals with Qatar, with Middle East powers, maybe look again to try to get Russian gas back into Europe. Like, still the U.S. is not viewed as a reliable LNG supplier, because of that, those shutdowns. All international energy engagement, so any U.S. embassy or any U.S. agency that deals with foreign countries, they couldn't talk about fossil fuels. It wasn't only that they couldn't fund them.
They couldn't talk about it.
It's actually pretty amazing. I think some of our colleagues here in the room, we were in different State Department events in the region when you have to kind of say, you have to say energy and not say oil, but you know what I mean? Whatever. But I mean, it's like, how can you? Because the U.S. has been for most of the post-World War, or even most of the 20th century and 21st century, has been the world's largest producer of oil, gas, certain periods, coal. Been an energy powerhouse. Energy has been a big part of our foreign policy toolbox. And our ability to help other countries improve their energy security, to produce more. The Biden administration forbid diplomats, agencies to, again, not only to not fund, but not even to have energy dialogues with countries. So, and I think some things are sort of slow to coming back. I don't know how much it's. I think the new administration obviously has a very different policy, but it takes time. Also, you're telling
to reverse
these policies. Yeah.
One last question before I open it to other people. You can see clearly, the revitalization of the industries in America, but also, this AI boom, it consumes a lot of energy.
Yeah.
Are you actually a little bit confident that because these sectors are developing that there must be a reversal of these energy policies? Or you think that actually the United States should make the push and then other organizations and others will follow?
It's interesting. I think you had this whole drying up of funding, finance, investments, loans for fossil fuels that affected Africa. You had also the private market, right? It wasn't just the government. It wasn't just G7, World Bank, International Energy, but basically, Wall Street. And by the way, the incoming chair of the World Economic Forum, Larry Fink, he's one of the first to say, we gotta dry up fossil fuels, we've got to do this for our children, and it's good for investments, green economies. And now when he and his colleagues in Wall Street realize that they need energy, they're suddenly like changing their tune. And so first thing I'd say, wherever you are in the camp, the pro renewable, only renewables, pro fossil or fuel choice, don't count on these companies. When they join your coalitions, they leave your coalitions, do they really, when they were sitting in Wall Street and saying the ESG scores, we shouldn't give for fossil fuels, did they really think there was an alternative? But they have they have so many smart people working for them. No one ever said if we don't develop this gas in Tanzania, people aren't gonna have anything. They're not gonna have anything. So maybe we should allow, some investments in Tanzania, or maybe we should still allow World Bank to co-finance or guarantee loans or, something. I mean, so on the other hand, now, you're saying going ahead on one hand, sure, because the U.S. is an energy superpower and because we have an administration that wants to unleash that power, it's a huge advantage for us in AI and data centers. But on the other hand, I think we need to think about domestic energy prices. It's such a huge new demand sector that maybe, I don't know, it needs some thinking out, right? But if it leads to huge increases in domestic electricity prices, I think that this is going to be a problem for American manufacturing. It's going to also be an electoral problem for, Republicans going into the midterms if power prices are up. So need to think that out, how to do it right,
Okay, great points. I'll open up for questions. Please raise your hand and introduce yourself. Dr. Michael Duran.
Hi, I'm Mike Duran, and I run our Middle East Center here. Thank you very much for that very enlightening presentation. I'm a little bit disturbed by it, however, because it challenges my understanding of how people work, how human events unfold. I thought the profit motive was one of the strongest drivers of human behavior, and also I thought that people cared about the poor and people on fixed incomes, and I thought countries cared about their own power and so on. And so to see that all of these things can be frustrated by commitment to ideology, it's really striking. If you, Brenda, could be the senior advisor to President Trump for the rest of his term on this issue, and you wanted to say to him, you know, sir, you've only got 3 years maximum, maybe even less, to reverse what has already been done. What are the two or three major things you think he should do that could possibly turn the tide here and make it very difficult when the forces of goodness and light retake power usher in the utopia again, can make it harder for them to improve our life the way they've been doing?
Okay, excellent question. And I think just of the three things that you said you thought that companies were, you know, profit motivated, and you thought that countries care about their power, and you thought that people care about the poor. One aspect is one of the deep problems of the whole ESG policy. So, you know, some of you may not even be familiar, but your pension accounts might be giving to ESG rated investments that'll give you a lower return, but they'll help the political agendas of the buddies of Larry Fink and the Democratic Party basically, and you know, basically the whole ESG idea, which helped to dry up the finance for fossil fuels in the United States and around the world and led to higher energy prices, says that companies shouldn't be motivated by profit, but they should be, you know, these kind of good actors, and they should work with their stakeholders. You know, suddenly you're not an investor, you're not risking your money, you have no skin in the game, but you suddenly should have some influence over a company's decisions. This is very dangerous because companies are less, you know, we want them to be profitable. It's good for the public if they're profitable. And that way actually keeps companies out of politics or less in politics when they have to think about their bottom line and not just about, you know, some kind of goal that isn't connected to profit. Just a side point. But I think if I had that job with President Trump to advise on these energy issues, I would say first thing when you do the review of the international organizations, have to really look, you know, in a cutthroat way to the World Bank, International Energy Agency, United Nations. These are unelected people. They don't pay the consequences at all. The people, poor people in Europe, UK, and US have been, in Canada have been paying, and poorest people in the world in Africa paying for these mistakes. I think we should acknowledge these mistakes that hurt the world's poorest, you know, and all over the world. And so I think definitely these international organizations, after making these big mistakes, they should have their, at minimum, have their budgets cut, and they should not be allowed to continue, you know, in this manner. And this also, you know, kind of coincides with what the American people said in the last election. They don't want to be spending all this money for global institutions, for global government. And, I think it's a win, you know, win-win. Also, the decisions of like the International Energy Agency and the United Nations are used in lawfare against the U.S. government and oil and gas companies all the time in America. So you're seeing the Trump administration has to, you know, go to court almost every week over because of a report of an international organization on the climate, you know, on the climate issue. Half the so-called NGOs that are going to court received grants from the U.S. government. They're not really NGOs. They're not really independent NGOs. You know, they're gongos that have received government grants, and that's why this, the cut to US aid was a very important policy, even though many people are critical on both sides of the aisle. But most of this money was going, was staying in the United States and was going to very political organizations. And again, you can't really have, you know, what Trump calls energy dominance, but you can't really unleash American energy when it's going to be caught in courts all the time. So I would say it's very important to focus on challenging the findings of these organizations that the United States funds. If their data is correct, even if it works against the U.S. agenda, I'm fine with that. That's fair. That's their right. But if they're publishing things that aren't true, like we're on an energy transition and Africans should stop developing their oil and gas and it's going to be stranded assets, things, and that they don't need fossil fuels, things they knew were wrong, then yeah, there's really no reason to continue to fund these kind of programs. I would say, yeah, it's really important what you said about when another administration's come back. I mean, we've had this seesaw in American energy policy and international energy policy that's almost an impossible environment. Every 4 years, for the last, maybe almost a decade, we've been going absolutely, backwards. We go, no fossil fuels, make problems for it, this. Then we go back, energy dominance, unleash it, and we unleash, and then we go back the other way. And for companies that need to make a decision, I know that they see the United States as more unreliable in terms of an energy, legal environment to make energy investments. United States, Canada, Europe, and UK for sure. I mean, it's like companies are running, running from there, right? But that they find it much more, it's much more easier to do an investment in Latin America or in industrialized Asia than the United States and Canada because of the changing regulatory environment. I think it is important. And it's also important to do, I would say to both sides of the aisles, to stop doing things by executive order, because it's really not a solution, right? It buys you time for a couple years, but it really, I think, both sides really need to do legislation.
Yeah, another question? Yeah, please. Sorry, the mic.
Thank you. My name is Francois Baird. I'm with the Energy Policy Research Foundation, setting up an Africa initiative. There are four areas. You mentioned off-grid solutions. Don't you think countries and World Bank and so on should be forced to finance grid development in Africa? Because without distribution, it's no use generating power. And then European net zero legislation that forces even American companies to report is going to constrain them going into Africa and supporting the development of all these fossil fuels. And then Africa is deeply in debt. So the ability of African countries to really borrow more money, to spend more money on grid development and generation, I think is severely limited. China owns most of that debt. And lastly, isn't the entire solution to privatize all utilities in Africa?
Mm. You have a set of questions.
Yeah. on the grid, definitely our world international energy policies undermine the prospects of grid development, because if you do off-grid solar is basically what you're doing, you're not extending the grid, and if you don't have a reliable grid, it's kind of like self-fulfilling prophecy. So a company that comes in, all they can do is, well, they're going to buy generators and generate their own electricity. They're not going to pay in the grid. And I agree with you that we need to see having reliable grids as a part of infrastructure, just like a country, even if it's poor, is going to have a functioning airport. It's going to have if it has a decent road system, would be considered an important part of its governance and its ability to increase its economic growth. So, I mean, definitely we used to see having the grid as a functioning grid as very important. I think, sure, of course, I'm fuel neutral, which means I'm not for renewables, against renewables, for fossil fuels, against nuclear. Certain places in Africa or certain places in the world, certain places, I was just recently in Ottawa and Canada, and people are talking in northern territories, and certain remote locations, off-grid energy is what you're gonna have. I don't know, northern Canada is not gonna use off-grid solar because they'll freeze, but it's gonna be off-grid, like that's just a reality. But for most, our policy needs to be to bring people into the grid and not just think of some sort of local solutions. That it's also, having a grid also determines whether the energy resources that you have in Africa will be developed for the domestic market or for export. So let's say 40% of natural gas discoveries between 2010 and 2020 were in Africa. They had a boom. Most of these weren't developed, and almost all of them were developed for export. So saying if you have, why is the whole international governance or institutions part important? If you, I'm a big fan of Tanzania. I've traveled there many times, love the place. So they had some nice gas discoveries, right? But they're not so huge that they're very attractive for LNG. But if you don't have a real domestic market, it's just gonna sit offshore and indeed to be a stranded asset, right? So you need that grid. You need people hooked up actually to bring their gas resources to their own, to their own markets. Again, this debt ratio, this is the big problem. Like why do the international policies hurt Africa mostly and not Europe and the United States? Is that, well, if a town, Potomac, Maryland wants more power, okay, so the private market will build a power plant there. They don't need the World Bank. But because of the high debt ratios of African countries, the high debt ratios of their utilities, of most of their companies, without some sort of matching or guarantees from World Bank and international finance, they can't attract the investments. So, it's really, this, the idea that, and the World Bank knows this, the idea that they know this and they still dried up the finance for 5 years to Africa, it's pretty shocking.
Okay, one last question. Yeah.
And introduce yourself.
Will Pack, also from the Energy Policy Research Foundation. So I obviously agree with everything you've said so far. I think I appreciate that this message is being pushed out. One of the things I wanted to circle back to was when you're talking about how one of the great things about the U.S. being a net exporter of energy, being more dominant than we were before in our energy production, we're able to help people that don't have that kind of energy resource, whether or not it's available in the ground or it just hasn't been built up. My question is, other than direct foreign finance, how do you see the U.S. energy industry or the U.S. Department of Energy getting our energy resources somewhere like Africa, where we really cannot export natural gas there because for most countries, liquefied natural gas is still kind of a luxury fuel because of the cost of import terminals. And obviously, there's a need for refined products, but there's a lot of infrastructure that has to be put in place before we can start shipping things internationally within Africa. How do you see us being able to assist? And we know Secretary Wright cares a lot about energy poverty in Africa and wants to try to help. How would you advise him to go about doing that?
Right. So first,
can I answer quickly? To emphasize a point we were discussing earlier. I think in U.S. administrations sometimes underestimate the power of signaling. For example, there is this huge pipeline that is developing in West Africa from Nigeria to Morocco, and the purpose was and the aim is to diversify from Russian gas. And so far, until I think lately, there was no U.S. administration supports this, or this is great. And sometimes just signaling that is sometimes enough to push other countries and us, especially the private sector, to have the confidence in investing in it. So anyway, just a little tangent, but right. I think sometimes the just support, vocal support is very important.
Right. So well, I think, like, as first thing, it's a very important point you mentioned about Secretary Wright. So Secretary Wright was the founder and CEO of Liberty Energy, that through most of the past, like, 20 years, his sort of personal passion and his personal philanthropy has been extending clean cooking in Africa. You know, people might not even really understand this. It's not a sexy enough issue or cool, you know, that people can understand what this tremendously means for women, children, for public health. Like, if you haven't traveled to a place without electricity and see how people live with the indoor pollution, it's hard to understand why. I mean, this is truly one of the most important human rights and human dignity and human, you know, development issues. And Secretary Wright, as a private individual before he was secretary, this was like his personal passion and philanthropy. And again, it's something that mostly benefits women and children who spend more time in the homes with the indoor pollution. And you know, it's an incredible project. And so what can U.S. companies, you know, what can the U.S., how can the U.S. interact with Africa and improve energy access? So I'd say a couple things. First thing, I think, you know, picking up on Zeynep's point about the energy signaling or climate signaling, the first thing, for years, we're telling Africans, keep your oil and gas in the ground. There's an energy transition. I mean, read all the reports that are referenced in this report. You know, the theme is that you don't need oil and gas. You know, you don't need you'll have renewable energy, and you should be mining critical minerals, not developing your resources. So many of them, you know, they take these institutions serious, they take our government serious, and they actually, you know, are following these paths. So I think really it's important, like Zeynep said, the messaging. It's really important that it's not just about U.S. energy, but yeah, that Africans deserve energy, and the way to get it is through development of their own fossil fuels. Second, you know, it might not be U.S. exports to Africa, but again, this signal, I like your point, that this signal to get U.S. companies back in developing oil and gas in Africa, and hopefully thinking, again, getting the World Bank, helping them to think about the demand. I mean, they have to go by profit, but still figuring out ways that it's profitable to develop these energy resources for the domestic markets and not just for export. And then third, I would say, is LPG, which that could, you probably are more of an expert on, but I mean, I know U.S. has a little different because of the climate in Africa, most African states versus the United States, has a little different mix for that works right. But liquefied petroleum gas, you know, what we sometimes call in U.S. it's often just referred to as propane or cooking gas. This can go a long way in Africa, but you know, it's for private companies to make the case if that's the right export market. And again, we need to tell the truth, okay, to our populations that, you know, there is no energy transition. Renewable energy can't replace fossil fuels. It works with fossil fuels. You might, you know, and that doesn't mean that actually does, that isn't necessarily something against the climate policies. The fact that something isn't working doesn't mean you continue to do it. You know, so think of something. For someone that's their priority, they should have to think of something better.
First thing, it's already 3:30, but Brenda, pleasure having you to discuss this very important topic, and thank you for your insights. We hope to have you again soon, and thank you all for joining us today. I hope this discussion was insightful, and please stay with us after the event to chat a bit with Brenda. Sure. So yeah, thank you all, and thank you, Brenda.
Thank you. Thank you, Zeynep.